listeners to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rosen. I'm here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Each week on Connect the Dots, we connect the dots between your personal and community and family well-being and what's going on in our total environment. We connect the dots between the healthfulness and purity of our food, water, air, and earth. We talk about our communities. We talk about our society. We connect the dots between what's going on in all of the areas of our world and the ecological stability of our habitat, planet Earth. Each week on the show, we talk with different experts, activists, thought leaders, scientists, authors, poets, filmmakers, and more about all of the facets of our interconnected world as they affect our health and well-being. On today's show, I'm happy to welcome two local grassroots activists from Westchester County, New York. For those of you not familiar with Westchester County, it is an affluent suburb north of New York City where many notable people reside, among others Hillary Clinton. Our guests today, Brooke Packard and Susan Rubin, Dr. Susan Rubin, are local organizers and activists in that county. And, as we speak about the resistance and need to unite to oppose the agendas of Donald Trump as they grow harsher and more despicable, it seems, with, each passing day, I think it's really important and, kind of really necessary to sort of take the pulse of the resistance in different locations. While we can see a lot of inner city activism all across the country, and we have upcoming marches in the week that this show will be broadcast, protesting the separation of families in almost every city, major city, how are people doing who live in other areas? And I think looking at this affluent suburb of Westchester County presents a real picture. So welcome to Connect the Dots, Dr. Susan Rubin and Brooke Packard. And please, if you wouldn't mind taking a moment to just introduce yourself to our listeners.
Hi, this is Brooke Packard, and I am a storyteller, a musician, and an educator who's been working with kids of all ages. And I see a direct connection between that work of increasing awareness and motivation so that we are all taking action for a more just world. I believe democracy is about more than just voting or reforming the United States' broken political duopoly, and that we can heal this system, we can unify more people when we stop the incorrect and limiting labels of words such as Republican, Democrat, or conservative, liberal, or any of those binary limiting labels. Discussion's the answer, and I met Susan as we had a pipeline fight, which we can talk about that later.
Great.
Yeah, thanks, my name is Susan. Okay. My name is Susan Rubin. I am a food and environmental educator. I'm a retired dentist. And over the years, my quest for healthy food, clean air, safe water has resulted in me learning more about politicians and politics and legislation, both local and national, than I ever thought I would. I've lobbied in D.C. for better school food. I've participated in civil disobedience, including arrests, with the Keystone Pipeline, and I've been working with other pipelines. Thanks to Bernie Sanders, I am now a registered Democrat. And unfortunately, I've discovered that my perspective is not super welcome in my community in Westchester County. I do live less than a mile from Mrs. Clinton. There's a lot of tribal kind of rah-rah cheerleading up here, and sometimes a lack of focus on the actual issues. We've got a, who was it? Eleanor Roosevelt that said, great minds talk about ideas and small minds talk about people.
Yeah, Eleanor Roosevelt, I'm a big fan. She's really a role model for all of us in, in getting involved and stepping up. So can you, Susan, give our listeners just a sense of, I think you've sketched out the culture. I'm sure more will emerge about that. But how does this kind of, you know, just kind of yay for this person and bah for that person fail to translate into dealing with specific issues facing Westchester County or national issues?
Well, I think part of what it is it's there's still a don't rock the boat mentality. We're still, you know, the Democrats up in my region are still really clutching on desperately to the status quo. You know, for instance, Congresswoman Nita Lowey is running again. She's 80 years old. Her net worth is $30 million. She hasn't been challenged at all. You know, and then, you know, further down county, Elliot Engel, who is also a long-term congressperson, at least he's got some primary challengers. And to me, that's where democracy works, right? Because that way we can have debates, we can have discussions of issues. And even if Mr. Engel wins, you know, maybe he'll be a better candidate. Maybe he'll make some changes, like stop taking money from the sugar industry and the, you know, the military industrial complex, things like that. But there's such resistance to any of that. It's a real vote blue no matter who, and, you know, vote, when, you know, I don't really have anybody that I'm excited about voting for, quite frankly.
When you say that Nita Lowey was unchallenged, you mean that she basically just sailed into the Democratic nomination without anybody coming along to engage her from the liberal moderate left about, you know, what issues there might be, so that as a result, when that kind of thing happens, does it mean that all the positions are just very status quo and centrist? I mean, what's your analysis?
Yeah, that is exactly it. Now, last time around, Nita Lowey ran completely unopposed. She didn't even have a Republican challenger. And, you know, she did just vote to, you know, give the Trump military budget a 10% pay raise. And no one questions anything. She's literally phoning it in, and everybody's okay with that. And to me, that is unsettling.
What do you think, Brooke?
I agree with Susan 100%. I mean, we both shared this, the same experience, which is after November 2016, people were very mobilized. People all of a sudden felt they were woke and they wanted to jump in and participate in democracy. However, you know, many for the first time, and they all went to the Women's March. And, you know, I've sat in circles of women, and I want to correct the Westchester is a county comprised of many towns. Some are affluent, some are not. Some are decidedly urban and do not have decent they don't have decent education systems. They don't have decent representation. They are not heard. And the privileged, mainly white women, sort of got together and formed Indivisible, which is very strong. And Indivisible has flexed its muscles getting people elected and to replace, for instance, our county executive, who is a total Trump clone. However, they leave it at that. They're not challenging, you know, for instance, in the Engel race, he has three challengers, and Indivisible is using its clout and power to simply not say, okay, we want you to win. We want a house that challenges the current status quo and GOP, but we're not going to hold you accountable once you get elected. You know, there's no option for that. We're just going to accept that, well, hey, Lowey's worth $30 million. She may have, you know, real estate interests, that she's, you know, cleverly disguising in her office, and the same with Engel. You know, they're not forcing them to be better elected officials. And that's what concerns me.
Yeah, I mean, this is how basically we get this problem on the national level. When, you know, locality by locality, these Congress people come in and, you know, with a pat on the back and, you know, you're back in your place and everything. And then we wonder why on a national level, when Trump comes forth with these heinous policies, there aren't, you know, even though the Democrats are the minority, there could be a lineup pushing for the opposition rather than rubber stamping his proposal. And this is both needed, and it's also needed in terms of mounting interest and motivation for the upcoming midterm elections and beyond to, you know, the next national election. You know, people basically, they're seeing this kind of wan. It's like everybody, are they really working on behalf of the country to intervene in this horrific trajectory we're on? Or they're just kind of trying to keep their job and they're kind of helping each other keep their job? Like, you know, it just doesn't translate well.
Correct.
Your comment?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, and
no,
and so,
I agree completely. My hope with Indivisible was that it would become a way to educate the voters, that we would begin to get engaged voters. Look, I'll vote for your stupid centrist candidate, you know, if I don't have a choice. But I need to know why, and so do other people. We need to have a dialogue. We can't shut down and publicly shame, which happens all the time, people who disagree with the status quo. It happens all the time.
Can you give us some examples of that?
Well, Indivisible has a Facebook group, which I've left, of 4,500 people. That's pretty substantial. It's filled with what I mainly call Trump porn, like, oh, my God, can you believe you've done this? You know, everything gets titillated, and people put their opinions about how horrible it is. And any time I have questioned the status quo, I have said, let's look at Nita Lowey's record. Let's look at Elliot Engel's record. I have literally been called a Russian bot or a Russian operative. I am not freaking kidding. And you said, haven't you been called a racist or you've been called an anti-Semite, Ms. Rubin.
Yeah, I've been called an anti-Semite because I questioned something. But, you know, there's also, you know, still a lot of Bernie bashing, which, you know, I guess they forget that 45% of the Democrats actually voted for Bernie leading up to the election. And, but, yeah, it's this whole, you know, vote new blue no matter who. But, you know, sometimes I think that this sense of outrage is not helpful. You know, I feel like it actually strengthens the other side when you're just talking about how bad Trump is and you're not putting out, you know, ideals. I often put that Eleanor Roosevelt quote on the Indivisible Westchester page about, you know, small people discuss people, big, you know, wise people discuss ideas and concepts, because we're not rising above. We're staying in the trenches and we're being snookered into this polarity of we're right and they're wrong. And, you know, by doing that, we're not getting anywhere. I actually have a Facebook like TV show that I do with a fellow Chappaqua person who is he's a Tea Party Trump voter. And so it's called We Have Issues. And what we did leading up to the last local elections, our community was just bashing each other and not listening. So we did this show to demonstrate that we could actually have opposing views and we could talk about issues and disagree on things and be civil and listen to one another. And actually we found that there were many things that we agreed upon. But I have people up here that are like, how could you even have a friend that's a Trump voter? And it's like, shoot, man, I've got family that are Trump voters. You know, you have to engage the other side and work forward. But, you know, they are just in that, you know, I got my pink hat on my head and I'm right. And my gal should have been in there. And they're not hearing and they're really not up to speed on issues, both local and national.
You know, I'm going to, ask a sort of provocative kind of question because it's, you know, we share an outlook. We're, you know, same generation or thereabouts. And recently I had a major high school reunion And, you know, when I reflected on it, I basically decided that I couldn't go because I didn't really feel it was going to be constructive to come to a social gathering and in the name of, oh, well, it's rude to discuss politics socially, just go along with the status quo out of politeness or kindness to the woman who had organized this and listen to what you're describing, the Trump horn and all the rest of it, without a real ability to engage. And why did I conclude there was no, you know, kind of potential to engage? Because 5 years earlier at our prior reunion, when I started to just mention some, you know, the environmental issue and my concern for it, that was pretty much all I was saying. People were like, jump down my throat. No, no, let's not talk politics. We have to be nice. This is stressful. And I went to a girls' school for, intelligent girls in New York City. And, you know, all these people had become professionals and moms and everything, you know, you would expect for the most part. They had no tolerance, I was kind of shocked. We were coming out of, you know, the time of ferment and all of that. And, you know, they were happy to have kind of made it to whatever place and, you know, the kind of economy that they could, you know, as women, that was a big achievement, and they really didn't want to hear of anything else. I think that what we're going to the heart of here, what I'm trying to bring up through sharing this, is, you know, what happened to, you know, our generation of women? It's kind of like, instead of looking at issues, it's just like, hey, this one woman had been elected, then finally I'd have a representative. I mean, the political naivete and lack of curiosity or a sense of history is kind of overwhelming, I sometimes feel. But, you know, I did a piece on TruthOut about this, talking about Oprah and her influence on people. But what happened to this generation? These are educated women, they're professionals, they're intelligent, and yet when it comes to this area, they're almost functioning in what I would describe as like a naive, childlike manner. Your comments.
Well, they have what they want. I mean, the women you're talking about are privileged women of privilege. And what I've discovered I had the privilege of being beaten up by a cop while I was watching my husband commit civil disobedience for Occupy Wall Street. And I consider it a privilege because I was like, wow. You know, no one's immune. And with this new rapacious agenda, everyone is vulnerable. Everyone is going to be a sacrifice zone. And your privilege isn't going to protect you. But what happens is when you bring up white privilege or economic privilege in these groups, they think that all their good works and good intentions can eradicate privilege. They think that that makes it disappear. And it doesn't. You know, it is a responsibility. It is to some who've been, you know, given much, much is expected. I think it's biblical. And I think, you know, like I'd never, for some reason, it was just my temperament, bought into that, you know, our main goal is to bust the glass ceiling. You know, we can unify over an empty corporatist. If you don't want to get into anti-capitalist, but just take corporations, an anti-corporatist model, we can bring in everybody. That can be a huge tent. But again, an example of being harassed, when I brought that up on Indivisible's Facebook group, people would say, who pays your bills? You got to love corporations. It's like, wow. You know, so I think, you know, you get used to the convenience. You get used to the convenience and maybe they're old enough to know they've got to fight or falsely believe they've got to fight the glass ceiling, but they're not old enough to remember Margaret Thatcher.
You know, it's this meritocracy. They're still buying into the meritocracy, and I often remind my fellow neighbors and community members here in Westchester, you know, we got this way. Our towns, the towns that are lily white because of redlining. And many people, educated women, don't even know what redlining is. Fortunately, there's a little hilarious, what is it, Adam Ruins Everything, a little 2-minute cartoon that invokes humor to explain how redlining works. But, you know, so we have an underlying racist system that created this privilege. It really wasn't, you know, this meritocracy idea that, well, you work really hard and you, you know, you get what you blah, blah, blah. It's BS. And, you know, I often remind them also that the Trump is a system. He's a symptom of a deeper problem. He's not, you know, he's a symptom. He's not like once we impeach him, you know, the world doesn't get sunny and we all go back to brunch. We have deeper problems. And that's, you know, he is reflecting that. And we have to see that. And instead, we're still, you know, getting sucked every day into his skillful use of media and images and words. And, you know, the indivisible people like to say how stupid he is. And I don't think he's stupid. I think he's diabolically brilliant. I think the guy's a savant. And you know, that doesn't mean that I like him. It means that I'm looking at this system and saying, how do we get out of this mess rather than, you know, how do we go back to sleep and elect our girl? It's we've got to get a little deeper than that.
Well, also this whole, Mueller situation with Trump, I certainly wouldn't weep, you know, tears if he were no longer in power. At the same time, the inevitable question is, who comes next? And if we're not thinking about that, I can tell you that the business planners certainly are. The corporations, their lawyers, you know, they have probably multi-strategies for multiple different options to deploy in the case of this, that, or the other. So whatever happens, they have a plan. It could even be that Trump finally is taken down at the moment they would prefer for some reason because he's become an embarrassment or they don't like the tariffs or, you know, whatever combination of things, you know, is or is not working for them. But it's just the thing that appalls me is that, and it's not a conspiracy theory to say that large corporations have strategic and planning groups and marketing groups. It's really a statement of incredible ignorance to call that a conspiracy. I'm not going over the bridge with the Illuminati thing, but, you know, this is just basic 101. They're planning for various eventualities. And guess who can't see beyond the, you know, latest picture or outrageous statement or absurd remark and gets all fixated and whirligigging around that and not thinking about a strategy or what comes next? Our so-called side. So, you know, and it's so easy to be distracted, and it's almost entertaining when you say he's a savant. It's like, yeah, in a way, if you, you know, like a little abuse mixed in with your politics, some could find that entertaining, you know, what he has to say on some level, or kind of enjoy feeling the outrage. Because maybe, and Susan, you would know about this too as a healthcare provider, but, you know, you're feeling adrenally depleted by the whole situation and, you know, having to kind of prop yourself up. And this, if anything, is stimulating temporarily. Your thoughts on
that? Yeah, we're creating new neural pathways that just, yeah, feed into this stuff. And, you know, I do what I can on a daily basis to integrate humor into my life and just, you know, kind of chill out from that kind of outrage. But, you know, Brooke, and I will say that Brooke is a source of humor for me often. I mean, she has a little saying about Pez dispenser.
Tell us about the first time I've ever spoken with her. What?
Oh, yeah. Well, every time, it's just sort of, I like reframing things as little metaphors. And one is just the Democratic Party candidates are just the next person in the Pez dispenser. You know, that's all we're getting. And it's interesting because you see, again, in these privileged groups, you'll see someone say, you cannot challenge. coach, Elliot Engel, out of the blue. We had a local person, very progressive person, who wanted to run for District 37, which is, you know, a total crazy district, when the representative, George Latimer, was elected county executive and for the state Senate. And someone really wanted to do it, someone with a great progressive background, and they said, no, you must wait your turn. And everybody has to wait their turn. And so when you go like, gee, you know, I remember in 2000 or so, someone moving from out of state to New York and bumping everybody out of turn. Now, who was that? You know, and they're like, oh, I can't, you know, like the cognitive dissonance is stunning.
Well, just for people who are non-New Yorkers, I'll mention that the someone that Brooke is talking about is Hillary Clinton. No, she didn't grow up in either upstate New York or certainly not in the city, even though, you know, she's a cognoscenti and, you know, loves soul food and everything. You know, she came from, a different background and moved to our state. You know, where is this idea of it's not your turn? We have a crisis. Where is the badminton rules that are, like, dictating how these people are claiming people ought to behave in a crisis? I mean, by definition, a crisis is not the time when you move in a slow and stately way of, you know, correcting your understanding first and then learning how to listen, you know, peacefully and then, you know, gradually playing nice with others for, you know, several millennia until you finally get to the place where you try to move the dime a little bit. I mean, we're not actually in that kind of time frame anymore. Where does this whole idea of it's not your turn come from?
I have no idea. I think it's to maintain the status quo. I think it's, you know, like the local, in my town, the local Democratic leader is literally a bully, worth hundreds of millions of dollars, mocking. I mean, I've been to their meetings, you know, as a guest and seen them mock people who question Andrew Cuomo. We, you know, just stop. You know, you cannot question Cuomo because this is his Democratic Party. You know, we're really in a lockdown situation. You know, it's and wow. I don't know how to. And I was looking towards the people of privilege, the people of education, women with a heart, to open the conversation, to listen to others, and they don't even listen to people of color. That's what blows my mind. Okay, don't listen to another person who disagrees with you and may look like you, but at least listen to women of color.
And where did you discover that they don't listen in this way? I mean, how did you see that in
meetings? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's my experience. You know, they don't.
In other words, if someone raised their hands and then they said, I'd like to speak, and then they spoke, then nobody was listening, and then they acted as if that person hadn't spoken?
Well, they don't have town meetings and mm-hmm. open dialogue. They've structured themselves very hierarchically. There's a small group of people, I'm talking about Indivisible, who meet regularly, and they determine what the agenda is going to be. And their agenda at this point is to blue wave, baby, and it's to elect Democrats. Any blue will do. There was a woman of color who was part of that, and she left because they wouldn't listen to her. And I actually said, oh, she was just too strident. You know, she was just so there's no opportunity to really speak. The only place it happens is on the Facebook page. So, and I've been at meetings where I remember the first meeting I had with their social media group. Everyone was introducing themselves, and I said, you know, this is my background, and I knew that, and gave it, and I said, and I knew that on no matter who was elected, my job would be the same. And I could tell, like, oh, can't trust her.
But the Indivisible Westchester Facebook group, you know, while it may say that it's got, you know, 4,000, the diverse voices have basically ghosted. They've quietly walked away. You know, I stayed longer than I should have myself because I felt like diversity of opinion and diversity of perspective is needed. I mean, I grow food. I don't just grow one you know, crop of zucchini everywhere. I grow a lot of things because that zucchini might not work this year, right? So it's the same sort of thing. We need diversity and we don't have it. So, you know, like for instance, we have a surge group, which is showing up for racial justice. They meet twice in our county every month. I'm always trying to encourage these indivisible folks to come, but it's basically indivisible is an echo chamber. They're doing the work of, you know, the Democratic Party, the centrist corporatist Democratic Party. It's really, you know, their goal is to defeat Trump, but they don't have any real, you know, strategy long term. I don't see that they have any real, you know, oh yes, keep families together, right, with this recent stuff, but they're not looking at systemic about like, hey, abolish ICE. You know, like looking at like how did these things happen? How did we end up with this horrific immigration piece? They're not looking at that. They're just looking at how horrible Donnie is this week. And it's a dead end.
They're also playing into the existing system. They want to start their own PAC. So therefore, they can never speak out against big money in politics because they want to be their own PAC. They are power brokers, which is not the answer right now. We need people power.
Yeah, no, that's a very big deal. And then, of course, let's just sketch it out. Let's start out with the very first question. Let's cross that off our list, and then let's go from there. So, agreed, trust is worth. Okay, now let's suppose that, you know, through watching him in action, a centrist Democrat with maybe one of the chambers of centrist Democrats, that would be a huge shift. And right there, they come in. And then what plays out in terms of solving the systemic problems that brought Trump in? In other words, yes, we're better off. We're not being entertained by a lunatic or whatever, you know, a completely ruthless individual that's apparently ruthless to all. But, you know, what plays out if we get the centrist Democrats back, as all are, you know, hoping to, just as they wish they could just turn back the dial and all the problems besetting this country would just go away? But what would happen if we elected, you know, we got rid of the worst guy, and now we have, you know, what, like, I'd love to hear you guys describe or analyze. Got that. Why is that not something to be yearning for?
So, it's, Allison, some of what you said dropped out. So you could titrate it down. I'm not quite sure what the question is. Maybe Susan heard it and she can answer.
I did not hear that whole sentence. No. I'm sorry.
Oh. Okay. Let's say we, we get Trump out and vote in, a moderate centrist Democratic majority. Now we've gotten rid of the worst. What happens if that were to happen? The thing that everyone's fighting to have happen, in the indivisible group that you're describing in Westchester, can you just do a sketch or a picture of what's going to happen if we then get a bunch of centrist Democrats in and we haven't addressed and included and shifted toward a more progressive agenda? What would be the downside of that?
Well, I think when a building is on fire, you don't take baby steps to an exit. You run like hell. And, you know, to get a corporatist centrist status quo game back going, there'll be a lot of apologizing and saying, oh, well, we can't make big moves, and the corporations will continue to run the show, and, you know, it'll sound better. I mean, I'm watching that right now with Westchester Airport. You know, we have a new county executive up here. He's lovely. He's a lovely man, soft-spoken, very nice. But guess what? You know, there's 14 different private jets that just got leases at the county airport. So I have private jets going over my house every 3 minutes. And you know, that's the corporatist agenda, moving on forward. And, you know, the indivisible people, they're not going to say one word against this Democrat, you know, county executive. So it just changes the tone, but the ultimate end game remains the same as long as we, you know, put the corporatists and the centrists back in. You know, Trump is like a very acute infection with pus oozing everywhere. But, you know, the centrist game is more of a chronic, low-lying infection, a little harder to treat, actually. But, you know, the end game is the same. And so that's, I just don't understand. There's just no real critical thinking and strategy about what do we want? What kind of world do we want to live in? And that's where these Dems, these comfy Dems, they're just missing the boat. They're not listening to their sisters of color. They're not listening to people who are in, you know, impoverished situation. They're not addressing the increased dreadful income inequality that we have here in Westchester County. I mean, we have a 21% hunger rate. We're higher than the national average of people that go to bed hungry. And, you know, I work in community gardens and I'm trying to bump this up. And you know, they don't want to acknowledge that. And once again, it's really not about getting more cans and donations from, you know, PepsiCo. It's about overgrowing the system and changing the system because the system's broken. That's what caused that. And I guess it's going to have to get a lot darker before these folks are going to see the light.
Yeah, I think Susan expressed it perfectly. Analogy about the, you know, open sore or, you know, carrying a football-sized goiter on the size of your head versus the low-grade fever is really a good one. And I don't hope for the, I mean, I'll vote for what, you know, I'll write in when I can. I'll vote for, you know, if it's a crisis situation. But I don't think the answer is among this, you know, this duopoly. I think, you know, there's a great meme I saw the other day, which was had a bunch of like thugs, mafia thugs sitting there with their guns. And it said, "You don't like the mafia? Then change it from the inside." Yeah, which is what we've been told about the Democratic Party forever. And it's just like, there's a, you know, I have stepped in and tried to do it. And then when you encountered a bully, which says fall in line or else, no discussion. You know, I keep reminding them that, you know, the Republican Party ran as vice president in 64, Bill Miller, who prosecuted Nazis at Nuremberg. And it became the party of having an actual Nazi or Nazi sympathizers in the White House because it wanted to win at any cost. Is that what you want for the Democratic Party? Is that what you really want? And so I think the answer is, you know, let these fools play it out. Do what you can. You know, if one feels called to infiltrate successfully, do it. But I think there's better ways to change things. You know, I just signed up to be a child advocate today, you know, for children in Westchester who are facing deportation, to meet with them once a week and be with them, because that's a reality. That was a reality under Obama, 3,500,000 people deported under Obama. You know, and I'm not – let's just, I know we're dealing with something immediately, but let's deal with it. I think Sean King's real justice focus on getting DAs elected who are progressive has a much better shot of helping people immediately than reelecting Elliot Engel, because we want a blue house, whoop-de-doo, you know?
And I'm
I don't have much hope.
The DA of Manhattan was reelected in 2016 without any opposition, and he's the one who failed to prosecute Wall Street during the 2008 meltdown, but instead, you know, went after a Chinese family that had a local community bank for Chinese people that gave them loans so they could start businesses and buy homes in Chinatown. That was, those were the people that, you know, he tried to set up. Instead of going after the big guys, yay, you know, Democrats, Iris Vance ran completely unopposed.
Right.
You know, in the 2016. Yeah. No, I think getting better DAs, and I mean, we're seeing it in Philadelphia, and, you know, it's actually a major, major step, because there's still some peace, I guess, in that position. So, I mean, I love the idea of people becoming child advocates. What a fantastic thing. I guess people could do that almost anywhere. What are the suggestions that, of what you find constructive do you want to offer to our listeners?
I think self-care.
Yes.
If we're not taking care of ourselves, we're no good for anybody. It's not selfish. And by self-care, I don't mean buying a mani-pedi, you know. You know, eating well, eating small, preparing your own food, passing on those values to the next generation, passing on smaller is better values. What can you do one day at a time where you are? And envisioning the kind of future that we would like.
That's right. I do a lot to what I call overgrow the system. So I grow a lot of my own food. I teach kids how to grow food. And, you know, I do look at everything systemically because it's really not about this flash issue right now. And it really starts locally. For instance, you know, we all know we have a complete idiot in front of, you know, the EPA right now. But, you know, the EPA isn't going to save us anyway. We can save ourselves by, you know, starting local ordinances against gas-powered leaf blowers. Because, you know, a lot of people don't even realize those leaf blowers are completely exempt from all EPA regulations thanks to lobbying. But we can stop the leaf blowers right in our own towns. You know, so that's, you know, you got to work locally and you got to work to change the system. And it doesn't necessarily mean, you know, these electives. That being said, I am carrying petitions for Cynthia Nixon, and it enables me to have discussions with people because, you know, people say to me, well, I don't know if I want her because, you know, she's new. And I say, well, here's what it affords. By having Cynthia Nixon on the ballot, Cuomo becomes accountable. And we get to have more discussions, and we get to light a fire under his butt, which is what he needs. He doesn't get a free pass if he has a challenger, and that's what I thought democracy was about. So, unfortunately, there's a good number of people in my community who will happily sign that petition and vote for her even, but they won't carry a petition for her because they still don't want to push up against that status quo. So, you know, it's sad, but, you know, I just keep plugging along like a weed, like a dandelion. I just keep, you know, setting out seed and, you know, smart people know that the dandelion has a lot of good medicine, and dandelions are persistent and they're resilient. They never give up. And so, you know, that's kind of the role model I use.
I love that. I think that's really beautiful stuff. And just to let non-New York State listeners know, we're talking about New York's Governor Andrew Cuomo and challenger Cynthia Nixon. She's a first cousin, once removed, a college student, daughter of my cousin. They reside in Westchester County. And she's a foodie. She's a vegan in college. She's, you know, kind of looking at the environment and some of the bigger picture things. But there's a big loyalty thing. You know, will my family accept me? How do I do what's in sync with them and still, you know, go for the things, the dawning understandings that a next generation person may have, where they get a different picture and a broader picture of reality than, you know, what their success-oriented family may have been operating by. And, you know, so it's really the weight of the sort of financially vested past generations is being borne, by the negative effects of it will be borne by the younger generations. And yet the pressures of it are so, kind of burdensome that you can't even, people who would vote for Cynthia Nixon are afraid to defy the group culture and carry a petition for her. I find that really, that says volume about what you have going on there.
No, it's so bad. I was at, I'm also carrying petitions for Cynthia Nixon, and I was at a training meeting with a neighbor who is older, in her late 70s, who's been, and she was the one I've seen mocked in the local Democratic Party meeting, because she would say, what are we going to do about Cuomo? And they would just, you know, and they knew she was a Bernie person. And I brought it up. I said, we need to find a safe place to petition, because I don't want to deal with getting signatures on top of being harassed, which I know will happen. And there was this person who was the first person in the street to get your signature, you know, like moved into the neighborhood, and there they were, you know, here, sign this, you know, saying, I can't do it in this town. I cannot do it in this town. You know, just can't take the pain. It's that bad.
Yeah.
So this is the pain of entitlement and investment in the model that is, that creates a dilemma, because the ego structure is saying, I'm a good person. I oppose this horrible Trump man and, you know, yada, yada, I'm a good person. But meanwhile, the other side of the person is actually holding on for dear life to the systemic privileges that have enabled them to have their comfortable life without a real thought for the future, and with probably a lot of buried shame and guilt that they never want to creep up through the floorboards, you know, so that where they can, you know, kind of smell it or whatever, you know. And so then the resistance is not really the resistance against Trump. It's really the resistance to, in the psychological terms, to really look at our own participation systemically among the privileged classes, you know, in these social problems. And an absolute, so that's actually the real resistance. And I never liked that resistance for opposing Trump, because, it, you know, we want to be activated. We want to be in solidarity. We want to, move forward and progress and, you know, it's a lot more than just resisting, which is a very inactivated, shut down posture to be in my opinion. But this is actually the real nature of that resistance. And then, of course, you know, then they project their own blame outward on other people. What do you mean? You don't hate Trump? You don't oppose Trump? Don't you see that Trump is the worst? You know, and it's a very, it's a very simplistic and unnuanced and ahistoric position, you know, that just sustains your life at this time. You know, one of the things that one of you said in the program, and I've noted this too, because I also have some roots in a community that has very similar problems. It's not identical to what, it's actually not worse even than what we're talking about here. But, I mean, you know, what... It's really hard when, you know, you mentioned earlier that there's this belief, if I'm a good person, in other words, if I do some fundraising or I donate or I do this or I do that or I fund a village in Africa to, you know, learn to make handbags that they can sell abroad or something, or some entrepreneurship and, you know, or bringing water to Africa, maybe perhaps also to grow GMO vegetables there. Or crops, but, you know, we're bringing water, you know, so there's always this kind of like, I'm good because I went over to Africa. I've noticed this among philanthropy. And, you know, I've done something for a little village. That's what I can do. Whereas we have these mass systemic global problems that will affect the health and state of all humanity and all living beings on Earth that our, you know, corporate structures are driving over the edge. And that, you know, our goodness does not extend to, you know, I'm taking that apart because it might affect, for example, our portfolio, husband's job, blah, 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 whatever. you know, all of that. So, you know, how good are we, really?
Right.
Here's a question for you.
Mm-hmm.
Is philanthropy the runoff of a broken system? You know, we have these Bill Gates and these people that are gazillionaires, and oh, they're these big philanthropists. But what if they were just millionaires instead? Would we need philanthropy? You know, I mean, it's just I really, this is not my original thought. This is Woody Tash, who wrote the book Slow Money. But I really like this question. Is philanthropy the runoff of a broken system? You know, it's just, it's another way to look at it.
There's been a movement to say no more billionaires. You know, what if you took it up to 1 million, whatever the, you know, like $1 below a billion, what if? I mean, and you know, it's always astounded me, this is sort of a little aside, is like you hear these Wall Streeters, you know, and they're all around us, the people who crash the economy. I'm in the middle of them. You know, we need our bonuses the way a waiter needs their tips because we can't get by. We rely on that every December. And it's like, wait, people are putting you in charge of their money? You can't make it on your $1 million a year salary? Holy crap. Let me give my money to someone who makes 40 grand a year to invest. They know how to get by.
Yeah, that is true. The ones that are going to fall the furthest are really holding on so hard, and that is definitely part of this community. But you know, it's kind of funny when I go to Whole Foods, and you know, I bring my own bags, of course, being a bag lady and a tree hugger, and you know, the cashier will ask me if I want to take that 15 cents and donate it to, you know, charity. And I look at them and I say, you know, your boss is like the richest guy in this country. Why doesn't he do something? And you know, they just all kind of like look at me, you know. And some of them, I actually have to educate them about Mr. Bezos because they don't even know. So,
yeah,
we have a lot of work to do.
His people staff is on welfare, you know. And then,
I know, and
I'll tell you, his predecessor, Art Holzer, didn't give a dime to label GMOs. He didn't want it happening. He devised his own label. He undercut the whole movement. He was potentially on the backs of all the organic growers. He built a huge business and never gave back to protecting organic food.
And
he had the power
the whole,
to his own label in his own store.
And the whole labeling thing is also watering down from the original intent, which was to eliminate GMO, not label, eliminate. So it's
well, that's right. Well, they weren't going to get very far. Yeah, I mean, that was a tactical strategy. And to this day, I mean, this is a whole other topic. We really have a great threesome here. It's our time pretty soon, so we're going to have to sign off. We'll have to do this again. But, you know, I think also, and I'll just throw this in because we seem to be closing oddly enough on the GMO issue here, and then we're going to have to sign off. But, you know, I think we need to do a better job of educating left men because they're ready to jump down everyone's throats and find themselves on the pharma side of the health divide rather than understanding, you know, some of these more holistic things. But this will be our next conversation. We are definitely doing a repeat on today's conversation with Brooke Packer and Susan Rubin, just merely because I hope you've enjoyed it, folks. I've had the greatest time ever talking with these two activist organizers from Westchester County and, you know, getting their take on a variety of different things with a little of my own thrown in, too. Thank you for being with us today, Brooke and Susan. You know, we are definitely going to do a return number, if not take this on the road. Thank you, listeners, for being with us on today's edition of Connect the Dots. We'll be back next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Heads up, hearts open, keep marching forward with all our relations.
And there was me and there was I.